Ramsa Records, David Childers reteams with producer Don Dixon for Run Skeleton Run, coming May 5th. The lauded North Carolina singer-songwriter's latest effort features vocals and banjo contributions by Scott Avett of the Avett Brothers. Get your copy of David Childers' Run Skeleton Run on May 5th at ramsarecords.com.
I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. North Korea is one of those countries that has long been a thorn in the side of the West. And it's kind of remarkable in that it's this 20th century style communist dictatorship that most of the world has gotten rid of. Yet it seems to be stronger than ever, perhaps, this North Korean regime under the new leader, Kim Jong-un. It is also in some ways a hereditary monarchy. You're looking back, this is now the third generation of Kim that has led this country. And one of the things about this country, it's so secretive. It's really hard to get at what's going on there, what they're thinking. And with the importance of North Korea in the news today, we thought we'd owe it to our listeners to go and look into the history of this regime, try to break it down, try to explain why they've been a problem, why it's so hard to work with them, and think about what we could do moving forward to perhaps ease the tensions between the two, or at least get these guys perhaps under control. So today on The Road to Now, we are happy to offer you our interview with Dr. Sheila Greitens, who is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at the University of Missouri. She's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Center for East Asian Policy Studies at the Brookings Institution. She is an expert. She spent time in North Korea. She's an expert on China. And so we sat down with her, and she gave us a really great breakdown of what's going on, the background to it, and we really hope that you enjoy this episode of The Road to Now and walk away a little bit wiser.
Sheila Greitens, welcome to The Road to Now.
Great to be on with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. Sheila, obviously, North Korea is all over the news, really leads the news almost every night the past couple of weeks. We want to make sure our listeners have a firm grasp on the history of how the United States and North Korea reached this point in their relationship. Can you take us back to the beginning to understand what was the genesis for where we are now?
Absolutely. And you're right. North Korea has been at the top of the news. When I teach my class this semester, which is on American involvement in conflict in Asia, it's the number one thing my students have been interested in. And we actually recently saw just last week, Deputy Assistant Secretary Thornton, who's one of our point people for Asia policy at the State Department, was at a conference in Washington, D.C., and she said that this is the number one national security threat facing the United States. And that's something that's pretty serious. If North Korea is now, there's a lot going on in the world today. If North Korea is now at the top of the list, that means the U.S. government is taking the challenge very, very seriously. So I think it's great to be able to understand how that situation came to be.
Where do you begin? Do you begin before World War II or after World War II?
I really think you could go sort of even further back. America's involvement in Asia goes back a couple centuries, honestly. And that involvement was always sort of diplomatic. It was cultural. It was religious. At one point, Pyongyang, ironically, was one of the missionary capitals of East Asia. So that relationship has always been a commercial and economic, a religious and cultural relationship. But America's sort of strategic and modern political relationship with the Korean Peninsula really had its origins at the end of World War II. And, when the United States accepted the Japanese surrender and the Japanese signed the surrender documents on the USS Missouri, that really set in motion the process that led to the Korean Peninsula being the way it is today. And what I mean by that is that Korea had been a Japanese colony from around 1905, 1910. Japan's expansion in Asia, its imperial sort of, project and the expansion that led it to the moment where it bombed Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941. You know, that started with Taiwan and it started with Korea. And Korea had a long, difficult experience with Japanese colonialism. The Koreans resisted being colonized for the entire sort of first half of the 20th century. And so Koreans were, you know, very, very happy to be liberated from Japanese rule in 1945. The United States, when it was thinking about its planning for the occupation of post-war Japan, didn't give a lot of thought to the Korean Peninsula. And, you know, actually other places that Japan had occupied, the Philippines went back to being a commonwealth on its way to independence. The Philippines became independent in 1946. Taiwan was given back to Chinese administration, the Republic of China, almost immediately. And so that kind of left Korea in this odd place as having been a Japanese colony previously, you know, having been an independent country and kingdom. And so the occupation of Korea was in some ways an afterthought. And then it became very clear that the Soviet Union was advancing down from Manchuria, where the Soviet Union, the day in between the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Soviet Union had launched an offensive that took out a good chunk of Japan's land forces in Manchuria. And so the Soviet Union was coming down into the northern part of the Korean Peninsula. The United States needed to find a way to sort of create some stability in the situation. The way that process, there's a lot of back and forth. And originally, the idea was to hold free and fair elections in the peninsula in 1948, in the whole peninsula. But the northern half, which was under the Soviet sphere of influence, decided not to participate. And when the elections went ahead in the South, that created two separate spheres of influence, one under Kim Il-sung and the Soviet Union, one under Syngman Rhee and the Americans. And that was all before the Korean War even started.
Right. And a lot of people don't understand the legacy of World War II that's there. I mean, a lot of people know that this division between the two sides came out of the Cold War. But I think a lot of people have never really heard the story, which is, and one of the reasons we decided to drop the bomb, you know, if you know, according to the current historiography, when we dropped the atomic bomb, is we realized the Soviets, we had made a deal, the Soviets were going to help us take out Japan, and the Soviet border is just right north of the Korean Peninsula, and they were advancing there, and we were dealing with them in Europe and realizing that they probably weren't going to leave the places they had taken over during World War II. And if that were true in Europe, it probably was going to be true in Asia as well. And we learned that we were right about that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, especially when you look at what happened in Manchuria, you know, the United States has spent months and years fighting brutal, bloody, costly, very high casualty amphibious operations up the islands in the Pacific, including, you know, the battles at Iwo Jima and Okinawa, which had really high casualty rates. And as you know, the fears of what an invasion of the Japanese homeland would have to look like and the casualties that that would inflict on American forces were one of the reasons why the United States and President Truman considered dropping the atomic bomb. And so then to have the Soviet Union after, you know, at the very end of this say, oh, yeah, sure, we'll come in, hit the Japanese from the north, sort of at the very, very end after the United States had spent so many lives getting to that point. You know, then the United States was looking at that and seeing the Soviet Union taking advantage of that strategic opening that they saw. And you're right, they were also seeing a lot in Europe that was very concerning. You know, there was this decision after the original occupation force landed. It was actually two relatively junior officers who got out a map and decided that the 38th parallel looked like a reasonable place to sort of, you know, portion out the Soviet Union having control for now over this half and the United States maintaining control over the southern half. And I'm not sure anybody realized at the time exactly how consequential that decision would be.
So were there any cultural or ethnic differences between the North and the South that naturally existed before World War II?
You know, it had been administered as just, you know, the Korea under the Japanese. There are obviously, you know, some historical differences, different Korean kingdoms that go back centuries. But Korea as a peninsula is an incredibly ethnically homogenous place. There are some differences in dialect and customs. So it was a pretty cohesive place, very strong, you know, sort of ethnic and cultural Korean identity. Probably the biggest differences had to do with just geography and the way that the Japanese had developed different parts of the Korean Peninsula. But no, there weren't a lot of sort of pre-existing cleavages, or there wasn't a natural division between North and South.
This is another case of great power politics, drawing lines across territories and us dealing with them decades later. A callback to our episode on Syria with Sean Foley.
So following the Korean War, North Korea is under the influence of the Soviet Union. Ultimately, though, we think today of them being under the influence of China. Can you talk about the decade post-Korean War and how the political dynamics changed?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, even to get permission to launch the Korean War, Kim Il-sung had gone to Moscow, he'd gone to Beijing, and he'd essentially asked for Stalin and Mao's blessing. And what he got was a conditional green light. In the Soviet Union said ahead of time, you know, you can go ahead, but we're going to provide air support and no more. We're not going to send in ground troops. And the Chinese, you know, really hadn't made a firm commitment about what they were going to commit to other than, you know, sending some material assistance. But, you know, Kim Il-sung had gone to them and had essentially gotten approval before the events of June 1950. And so, you know, over the course of the Korean War, the Chinese did end up intervening in October of 1950 as they're seeing U.S. troops approach the Yalu River and the border, what's now the border with China. One of the things I think it's easy to remember is just how much movement across territory there was in the first few months of the Korean War. The war starts in late June. By September, U.S. and ROK forces and U.N. forces have been pushed all the way down to the Pusan perimeter, down in the southern tip of the peninsula. And then Douglas MacArthur in September comes around and does this landing at Incheon, where the airport is today, the Seoul airport is today, and then proceeds to push back northward. So there's just an incredible amount of movement of troops and people up and down the peninsula in this first, you know, really 6-7 months of the war. And they go, you know, as they're heading north, the Chinese get very nervous, come across the border and start pushing back down. And, you know, ultimately a good chunk of the what became the post-Korean War Korean People's Army was actually composed of generals and troops who had fought the Japanese first in China as part of the Chinese anti-Japanese war, and who then came back and fought in Korea as part of the Korean War in 1950 to 53. So you had, you know, a situation where both there were close ties both to the Soviet Union and to China. And after the war, Kim Il-sung had to sort of consolidate political control. One of the things he did was actually to purge a lot of the people who had the backing of the Soviet Union, had the backing of the Chinese political leadership, or had close ties to those generals, in part to just consolidate his own personal rule. And so the reason I bring that up is that when we actually look at what Kim Jong-un has done today by cutting out the people from his regime who had, you know, were perceived to have good relationships with, there may be some support from the Chinese, he's actually taking a play from a page from his grandfather's playbook, in that he's, you know, this is something that Kim Il-sung did right after the Korean War in order to consolidate power. And so it's interesting that you see, you know, an echo of that even in the last 5 or 6 years in North Korean politics. So then, throughout the Cold War, North Korea was very good at playing China and the Soviet Union off each other to get assistance and aid for his own domestic reconstruction and development projects.
So Kim Jong-un is purging those favorable towards China in his own regime. But isn't he isolating himself even by his greatest protector by doing that?
Yeah, to an extent, yes. But one of the things that's a problem for dictators is that your greatest protector is also then your greatest threat. And I think he's trying to balance those two things. You know, I spent a little bit of time in North Korea on a research trip in the summer of 2012. And it was pretty clear then that there's not a lot of love lost on a sort of ordinary people level between the North Koreans and the Chinese. So, for example, if you went into a restaurant or something, this is one of these, you know, highly controlled visits. But if you went in and you spoke Chinese to a shopkeeper or something, you'd get a pretty frigid response. And it's not like they were super friendly if you spoke Korean, but there was a noticeable difference. So, you know, I think that North Korea is clearly economically dependent on China. I think it's trying not to be dependent in a sort of political and a military security sense. And so I think that's, you know, in part what you see from some of the developments today. I think North Korea is moving from a nuclear arsenal where it was this small sort of semi-concealed nuclear arsenal of the type they had before. Really, you know, what that arsenal is useful for is creating enough of a problem that China will intervene and sort of stabilize things and presumably act as some sort of protector. The nuclear arsenal that they're moving toward now is one that has survivable nuclear weapons that and looks to be progressing toward a delivery capability that can hit the United States homeland. And the purpose of that is really to be self-sufficient, to be able to deter the United States, to have a very different nuclear posture. And so I think what we're seeing is actually a move toward a sort of a nuclear setup that will enable them to protect themselves and keep that regime in power no matter what China decides to do.
And according to the estimates we have now, how long are we looking at before they get that capability to be able to hit the American mainland?
You know, there's a lot of debate. So the Taepodong 2, which was tested last year, theoretically has a range that could hit the Western United States. Most analysts think that what we're probably looking at is sometime before the end of this administration. So sometime before 2020.
Wow. So Donald Trump may actually have somewhat of a responsibility to deal with this now.
I was part of a discussion in Washington, D.C. last week where, you know, one of the key questions that people raise is, you know, is there something different about this time? Because our North Korea policy has tended to be every administration comes in saying, we're going to do things differently. We're going to crack down. We're going to get North Korea to roll back its nuclear arsenal. And nobody's been able to do that. And nobody's been able to convince China to really sever its economic relationship that's keeping North Korea afloat. And so, you know, the rhetoric has tended to be, we're going to fix this, and then it doesn't get fixed. I do think it may actually be a little bit different this time because it seems to me that this administration, you know, what we're seeing from their public statements is that they perceive that the time frame they have to deal with this on is a lot shorter. So, you know, you heard a lot of discussion about strategic patience under the Obama administration, which is sort of a deterrence containment policy. Patience seems to sound a lot better as a policy if you think you've got time, right? That's a policy that works when time's on your side. And I think some of what we're hearing, at least rhetorically from this administration, is that they don't think time is on the U.S. side anymore, in that this advancing missile threat and the potential that North Korea will have to target the whole U.S. homeland by 2020 is something that they see as a fundamentally different threat.
Do you think how much of this do you feel like has to do with the changing relationship with China? I tell you, I taught at a Chinese university 3 summers ago. I taught a U.S. history class there, and incredibly well attended at a it was a flight school, actually, Nanjing University of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Incredibly brilliant students. And they asked me, at the last hour of the class, I said, all right, we're going to do Ask an American. You ask me anything you want to ask me, you know. And I made the caveat, look, I'm a Southerner, you know. I'm not every American, but I'm one. You can ask me any questions. And one of the things they asked me, and you could tell they were kind of like, should we ask this? They were like, what do Americans think of North Korea? And I said, well, you know, I'm just one person, but there's kind of this double-sided view we have of them. On the one hand, they're a real threat to the world. you know, we understand that they could destroy and kill lots of people. On the other hand, they're made fun of a lot in our pop culture, almost like, you know, like they're funny. I was like, so it's a double-edged thing. I said, what do you all think? What do Chinese people think about North Korea? And this is a group of, like, you know, 19 to 21-year-olds. And there was a pause, and then one of them said, we think they're funny too, and the whole classroom burst out in laughter. So I wonder if there's a generation gap there, you know? Like, is there a changing mood from China about North Korea?
You know, I think that there is. What we aren't sure yet is whether that changing mood is going to translate up to a change in official policy. So, you know, in the last 5 years, it's very clear that there's been a lot more criticism of North Korea. There have been a lot more derogatory remarks toward the regime, toward the leadership. And there really is a growing sense that North Korea is creating problems and messes that China is having to clean up, and that's not going over well. North Korea is not really in this for a partnership or for anything that advances China's interests, that it's kind of free riding off of China's sense that there's not necessarily a better option. And so I think, you know, you've seen real criticism of North Korea in the Chinese media and in, you know, sort of the varied opinions that you can find online. And I think those are real sentiments. China's looking at this and thinking, okay, I don't like supporting or propping up North Korea, particularly right now. It's not clear what a better option is from the standpoint of what Beijing wants. It doesn't want anything destabilizing that might lead to a unified Korea under the U.S. or aligned with the U.S. that's right on its doorstep. It doesn't want sort of a calamitous collapse scenario that sends thousands of refugees across that northern border into what are already economically depressed or struggling parts of China. And, you know, it doesn't want another war on its border. You know, China has decided, and it seems hard for them to change their minds on this, that sticking with the current regime is an imperfect, but the best option they've got.
It seems like we are possibly at a nadir in U.S.-North Korean relations when they were never that great. But was there a point in the recent history where there was an opportunity to do something about the situation? And we just were not able to.
You know, honestly, I'm not sure that there was a genuine opportunity that was within the United States' control. There have been a lot of suggestions that the United States, you know, start talking to North Korea, that the Trump administration, you know, open negotiations. And my own view is it's fine if the North Koreans want to talk, but it's not clear at this point what talking is going to get us. And we certainly shouldn't pay to do it, which is typically what has happened before. So, you know, there has been some dialogue with North Korea in almost every year of the past two or three presidential administrations. North Korea has made initial agreements that were supposed to sort of start the process toward denuclearization and the creation of peace, you know, replacing the armistice with a peace treaty, et cetera, et cetera. You know, there have been a couple of initial deals, three or four, depending on how you count them. And North Korea is the party that has significantly reneged on every single one of those. So it's just, you know, at this point, I think there's a lot of skepticism about what dialogue and even an agreement would accomplish. North Korea seems really good at finding the technical loopholes and, you know, announcing, okay, we reached a deal to freeze a plutonium program, but hey, by the way, we forgot to tell you we have this parallel uranium program. The regime has, at this point, has pretty much staked its domestic legitimacy, and I think its bet, its strategy for survival, on achieving both economic development and nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons were written into the Constitution about 3 or 4 years ago. And it's just hard for me to see them walking that back at this point, no matter what the United States puts on the table.
We've recently heard a lot of criticism of the Clinton administration and the negotiations and deals they made with North Korea. How should we understand that period in North Korea-American relations?
you know, dialogue and engagement were policies worth trying. And I think, yeah, I'm a social scientist, so I tend to look at this as you try to lay out ahead of time what would make your policy a success or a failure. The agreed framework seemed to me like it was a bargain that made some sense. It did successfully freeze North Korea's plutonium program for a number of years. The problem was that it left unaddressed an entire other pathway to achieving a nuclear arsenal. And that's the uranium program that the United States confronted North Korea over when Assistant Secretary Kelly visited North Korea in September or October of 2002. That's a pretty big violation of the agreement, at least in spirit. At this point, though, you know, it's sort of useful to learn those lessons. There was also a different leader in North Korea. There was a different administration in the United States. And North Korea's nuclear and missile capabilities are so much more developed than they were during the sort of agreed framework period, that I think we have to have a different conversation.
How does the situation look from the perspective of Kim Jong-un? Because we know the way we see it, but I think if we want to understand the conflict itself, it's worth getting into the head of the person we're dealing with here. So we see North Korea as an international pariah. We see them as a potential threat to long-term stability, a very real threat of a nuclear warfare, you know, something to be dealt with. How does this look to Kim Jong-un, and how does this affect his legitimacy in North Korea?
The negative stigma that we attach to the word isolation isn't really an automatic negative in the North Korean regime's way of thinking. It can actually be a plus if it sort of translates to ideological and sort of Korean purity. You know, it's useful to, as you said, to put yourself in Kim Jong-un's shoes. And I think what he's aiming at is survival. And survival as a regime, the survival of the leadership and of, you know, himself as the dictator. I think he'll do a number of things to keep himself there. He'll, you know, purge and replace whoever he needs to make sure that he has people around him who are loyal, and that there's no sort of faction or person who could emerge as an alternative leader. So includes, you know, his half-brother, Kim Jong-nam, who was the one just assassinated with VX chemical weapons in Malaysia. Kim Jong-nam was one of the other people who could sort of potentially claim the mantle of the Kim family legitimacy. He lived outside of North Korea. He'd been critical of the hereditary succession that had brought his brother to power. And so I think, you know, removing him was probably seen as a pretty important step to removing a potential alternative center of power. And I think if you're looking at what Kim Jong-un cares about and how he thinks things are going, the missile and nuclear tests are progressing. It's pretty normal for missile programs to have a high failure rate. The typical pattern is fail, 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 succeed. Because each unsuccessful test gives you the data you need to learn, improve the missile technology. You test it again. And what we've seen is that despite these failures, there's been pretty steady advancement in the overall program. And it's easy sometimes to kind of miss the forest for the trees there. Oh, this test failed. We don't have that much to worry about. What we've seen is very steady advancement in the missile capability, in part because they test, they fail, they learn something, and they fix it. And so, you know, I think if you're Kim Jong-un, you're seeing the missile programs advancing, the nuclear program, it looks like it's been advancing with the same sort of test learn pattern. You know, you're taking care of removing the people who are your biggest threats. And at this point, the official statistics suggest that the North Korean economy is still growing, and there's not a lot of indication that North Korea has been squeezed by sanctions in a way that it hasn't been able to adapt around, in part because the enforcement from China has been so low. And there have been so many areas where China isn't willing to cut off trade, coal imports, that general economic relationship. You know, if I was North Korea, I'd be concerned. I'd be actively managing these threats, but I'm not sure I'd be, well, I don't want to say I wouldn't be worried, but I think that's how I would see the pluses and minuses if I was Kim Jong-un.
Sheena, thank you so much for joining us today and helping to educate us on the history of U.S.-North Korean relations.
Not a problem. I hope that was interesting and enjoyed the discussion.
Oh, it was great. Thank you so much. Sheena Greitens, thank you for joining us.
It's wonderful.
Thanks. Have a great afternoon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today on The Road to Now. Our program is produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Edited by Bob Crawford and Ian Scotta. Paul DeFiglia provides our music. Please be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and rate us on iTunes. For more information about this or any other episode, please visit theroadtonow.com. For Dr. Ben Sawyer, this is Bob Crawford. Take care.